Good morning, Charlottesville. You are listening to Straight Talk on WPVC-LPFM, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Straight Talk is a series of interviews and conversations about legal and social justice issues affecting our community. I am your host, Andre Hanks. On today's show, we will be talking with John Childrey of the Chesterfield Commonwealth Attorney's Office and Rob Pogenglass about civil forfeiture. Rob Pogenglass is an ACLU attorney. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you. Good to be here. Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much for coming in. John, I'm going to start with you. Tell me a little bit about your background. I understand you went to UVA undergrad and that Cuccinelli was your roommate at some point in college.
1990, graduated UVA, so it's good to be back here in Charlottesville on this beautiful Saturday. I knew Ken Cuccinelli in undergrad, and he and I were roommates for a couple years, and he was in engineering school, and I was a history and econ major, so we didn't have a lot of classes in common, but yeah, I knew him pretty well in college.
He graduated in 90?
91. I think engineering is a little more rigorous than the college, okay. At least it was then, and I think he needed one extra year to graduate.
So I was actually in college with Ken Cuccinelli and didn't know it.
Well, there you go.
That's probably a large contribution to the reason why I'm not in jail right now. That's awesome. And you went to law school at William & Mary.
Yes, I did.
And tell me a little bit about what it was like being, I understand at some point you were the deputy AG in when Ken was AG.
I went to William & Mary Law School, graduated in 1993, and then became a Commonwealth attorney in Chesterfield in 1998. Just like so many Commonwealth attorneys around Virginia, just handling all sorts of cases. And then I got a phone call in the summer of 2012 from the Attorney General. Ken Cuccinelli had an opening in his office, and I went to work for him at the AG's office downtown Richmond for about a year and a half.
And when he left that spot, you went to Chesterfield?
Back to where I had come from, and I'm currently a deputy Commonwealth attorney in Chesterfield.
What kind of things do you prosecute? Are your dockets split up by type of case, or you just happen to be whatever comes your way? Or
I prosecute whatever crimes folks commit. I mean, it's the easiest way to answer it. Everything from speeding to murder.
Everything.
And for a time, I was the attorney in Chesterfield assigned to handle asset forfeiture cases. So I did that for 5 years for Chesterfield County, and then I also did it for 3 years working with a task force of detectives in different jurisdictions around Southside of Richmond.
Awesome. So, Rob, I'm gonna turn to you next. You also went to, well, where'd you go undergrad?
I went to Cornell College in Mount Vernon, Iowa.
Okay, and then you went to law school at William & Mary?
That's right.
And you are right now at the ACLU, but in between there, I think you had an internship at a Capital Defender's office?
Well, I was a public defender in Newport News for 3.5 years.
In Newport News?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, okay.
So, like John, handled everything from traffic court up to manslaughter.
Did you try those cases?
Yeah.
And so after that, did you go to the... I guess you must have had the internship at the Capitol Defender's Office before that.
Yeah, that was when I was in law school.
Okay, Capitol being, we're going to kill somebody, death penalty cases.
That's right.
That must have been intense.
It was. That was actually my introduction to the criminal justice system.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, so quite an introduction.
Threw you in the deep end.
Yeah, that's right.
So tell me about... you went from there to the Newport News Commonwealth Attorney. I'm sorry, public defender.
That's right.
And what'd you do there? How long were you there? And
I was there for 3.5 years, so 2010 to June of 2014. Handled a couple thousand criminal cases during that time. Things move rather quickly in Newport News. Lots of cases down there.
And how'd you end up going to the ACLU?
I saw that there was a job open to reform the criminal justice system, or at least try.
How's it going for you? Do you make any progress?
Criminal justice reform is a hot topic right now nationwide, but I will tell you that it's slow going in Virginia. I think Virginians just like incremental change. We're not a group for radical change all at once.
That's true. It's got its pluses and minuses, I guess.
Yeah.
But how long have you been at the ACLU?
I've been there about a year and a half.
Okay, and it's a 2-year fellowship?
2-year fellowship.
Mm-hmm. So we're not going to have you too much longer. You got 6 months left, Rob. I mean, you know, let's get moving.
If I can get civil asset forfeiture done in 2 years, I think that'd be a pretty big accomplishment.
All right. Well, let's move right on into that topic. This morning we are talking about civil forfeiture. So, gentlemen, John, let's start with you. Explain to me what civil asset forfeiture is.
When folks are suspected of having property that is either the products of certain criminal offenses or was used in substantial connection to certain criminal offenses, the current law in the Commonwealth allows those items to be seized and also provides procedures for a lawsuit to be filed in circuit court to see whether or not the Commonwealth can establish that those items should be properly forfeited under Virginia law. Now, most of the cases that come through the courts are also associated with a criminal case. You know, somebody's arrested, and most commonly in Virginia, we're talking about the vast majority of these seizures are incident to drug arrests. So somebody's arrested for distributing drugs. They might have some money in their pocket, and that money can be seized by law enforcement under current law. And there can be a lawsuit that's filed to see if that could be forfeited.
So basically, civil forfeiture is the police take your stuff because they think it's related to fruits of a crime.
Specific crimes that are set out in Virginia Code, yes.
So there are statutes in Virginia that say what kinds of crimes.
Correct.
Right. So if I'm just if I'm speeding down the interstate, let's say I'm going 71 in the 70 mile an hour zone on my way to Richmond, can they take my old Highlander?
Can't take your car.
No?
Cannot take your car
okay.
for that.
All right. Well, good to know. I was worried for a minute there. So you are listening to 94.7 WPVC, the Progressive Voice of Charlottesville, and this is Straight Talk. This morning, our guests are John Childrey of the Chesterfield Commonwealth Attorney's Office and Rob Pugenglass of the ACLU, and we are talking about civil forfeiture. The number to call in if you have a question for one of our guests regarding civil forfeiture is 284-9470. That's the studio line. So having had that cogent explanation and definition of what civil forfeiture is, Rob, I'm going to turn to you. Can you tell me what the problem is with this? Why is this a controversial topic?
Well, so right now the law in Virginia is that you can be stopped by the police and your money can be seized and the police don't have to charge you with a crime and the prosecutor can take your stuff.
Whoa, wait a minute. What do you mean the police don't have to charge you with a crime?
In order to start a forfeiture, there is no requirement in Virginia that a criminal prosecution be commenced.
So let's go back to me driving 71 on my way to Richmond in my Toyota. If Officer Friendly pulls me over and says, how much money you got in your wallet, and I happen to have $100, and I say, well, I got $100, I just stopped by the ATM, he can say, give me the $100?
Well, yes, although he's going to have some, as John put it, a substantial connection to some sort of drug crime.
In other words, I got to have a roach in my ashtray or something for him to take my $100.
Right.
Okay. Or he's got to think that I do.
He's got to think that you do.
Does he have to smell marijuana? If he smells marijuana, is that enough?
I think that would... That's probable cause. That would be enough to search your car. So, yeah, that would be enough to do the seizure for sure.
Okay. All right. So then he takes my $100 and then what? Does he write me a ticket or does he just say, you know, have a nice day?
Doesn't have to write you a ticket.
Are you serious?
Or, well, there's a new law that just passed last year that says that police have the option of giving you a receipt.
They have the option?
Yeah. There's nothing happens to them if they don't give you the receipt.
Okay.
But that was SB 721 last year, Senator Marsden. So they have the option of giving you a receipt when they take your money.
All right. So back to you, John. Driving down the road on my way to Richmond. Let's say I have an officer who smells the odor of marijuana. And he asks me how much money I've got in my wallet. And I'm stupid enough to actually answer his question instead of saying, I want a lawyer, go F yourself, sir. And he takes my $100 and he writes me a receipt or doesn't. He might try to charge me with something, but let's say, you know, all he's got is the odor of marijuana and he uses his probable cause, calls a drug dog, you know, they detain me on the side of the road for the next 2 hours and the dog goes around and around my car and doesn't find anything and they end up giving up. They don't charge me. But they got my $100. Then what happens?
Well, in Chesterfield, and it's similar to other places that I've talked with, the police have to report that seizure to the Commonwealth Attorney's Office. And the Commonwealth Attorney look at the facts. And in the case you cite, if it's me looking at the facts, I'd say to Officer Friendly, as you called him, why did you take this money? Mm-hmm. There's no basis to believe that this person is engaged in dealing of marijuana. That would be a felony, which is a threshold requirement for forfeiture of money related
so
to a marijuana
having,
case.
Just having marijuana, if I had a little roach in the ashtray or if the officer smells it, but there's no indication of dealing, like there's not a scale, there's not a box of baggies and rubber bands in my backseat or something like that, then we got no dealing PC.
Correct. And even a dealer that is a small enough dealer wouldn't qualify under Virginia's asset forfeiture law. So not only do you have to be a marijuana dealer, you have to be a felony marijuana dealer.
All right, hold that thought. The studio number, if you want to call in with a question for John or Rob on civil forfeiture, is 284-9470. John, let's go back to that for a second. You said you got to be a, you got to have a quantity dealer in order to do this. So if I am a drug dealer and I am dealing a small quantity, I hand my friend the roach that I'm puffing on to take a, and they I have now distributed marijuana, that isn't enough to make my $100 forfeitable.
That is correct in the example you give. And I want to make one other point. Rob is absolutely right. You don't have to be charged with any level of dealing for the for money to be able to be seized in Virginia. Mm-hmm. Suppose you're stopped, Officer Friendly, mm-hmm. and he says, why do you have $2,000 sitting next to you? Mm-hmm. And you say, I'm a marijuana dealer.
Mm-hmm.
I just sold $2,000 worth of marijuana.
Because I haven't watched my own videos on YouTube.
Correct.
Or else maybe because I've smoked so much of the marijuana and my brain is no longer functioning.
For whatever reason, you confess to that money being the proceeds, direct proceeds of marijuana sale.
Right.
Felony amount.
Right.
We can't charge you with that crime because we don't know the jurisdiction it was committed in. We don't
Whoa. I say I'm a dope dealer and here's $2,000 and you can't charge me with that crime. This is going to be news to many police officers in Albemarle County.
This is a very strict hypothetical. In my hypothetical, we don't know where you committed the crime.
Uh-huh.
You don't tell us that. All you
right.
tell us is this $2,000 came from weed dealing in Virginia.
Uh-huh.
Let's just assume that. We can take the money.
Uh-huh.
We can file a lawsuit for it and we can forfeit it, notwithstanding the fact that we have no criminal charge that we can bring against you.
Okay, all right. You got this look on your face, Rob. You got this smile going. Tell me what your thoughts are on that.
Well, I'd like to hear the public's thoughts on that. I mean, the idea that police can just take money from somebody based on what the person told them, and keep it, and there's no crime. There's no proof that a crime was committed in any particular place. It's just one person's word, and suddenly, you know, law enforcement gets all this cash as
a
result.
On that public thoughts question, I'd like to hear the public thoughts on it too. So call us 284-9470. But let me just sort of be the devil's advocate here with you and say, well, geez, you know, if somebody says I'm a drug dealer, why can't you take their money? What's wrong with taking their money if they say I'm a drug dealer and this is the money I got dealing drugs?
Well, you know, the patron of the bill that we support, Delegate Cole, has put it very bluntly. You know, this is un-American. The idea that we would take someone's property without a criminal process. We're taking the money based on the idea that they are participating in criminal activity.
Mm-hmm.
But then we're saying, well, we think you're participating in criminal activity, but we can't prove it in a criminal court.
Mm-hmm.
We're still going to take the money and the property anyway.
Mm-hmm.
It offends our notion that we're innocent until proven guilty. Civil asset forfeiture is an action against the property, so it's a little bit different. But
this is where you see those crazy cases, you know,
yeah.
U.S. versus $50,000 in currency.
Exactly. But that doesn't really comport with our idea of what a criminal case is, which is, you know, you have to prosecute a person, you have to prove they're guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. The idea that you can prove property is guilty, it's a very strange situation that doesn't really comport with our our idea of justice.
All right. Well, John, that's a little bit of a strained idea, isn't it? The idea that you're convicting the $50,000?
Asset forfeiture in Virginia has very, very long roots. That doesn't mean that, we can't debate it from time to time, but the law in Virginia of 1819 included a provision that gambling profits could be seized and deposited into the literary fund, which is where lots of asset forfeiture money goes currently.
Well, we used to have prohibition, too. I mean, it's got very long roots. It's kind of meaningless. Not voting has very long roots.
And it's good to look at these things from time to time and see if they still make sense. I think this statutory scheme does make sense. I think it works for Virginia. I think it's important to take the profit, if you can, out of these criminal enterprises. These are folks that are slinging some very dangerous substances. I don't know if you're aware, but in 2014, more people in Virginia died due to heroin overdoses than died in car crashes.
Yeah, but we're still talking about taking money from people who are dealing with pot.
Well,
so
that
I understand at the outside of any of these things, it looks sort of more dire the more sort of difficult your facts get. But do we have any kind of idea what the stats are on this in terms of, what kinds of crimes and what percentage of civil forfeitures or what percentage of money from civil forfeitures is related to what kinds of crimes?
I think one of the proposals that the Crime Commission recently made to the General Assembly is to have those statistics reported annually to the General Assembly so that records can be kept of those things. So right now there are some records in Virginia about how many things that are seized are actually returned to the person from which they were taken.
Mm-hmm.
I think in Chesterfield County, we return on average about 10% of the items that are seized because I think that, like in a lot of places, the police department in Chesterfield has very good training about what is and is not seizable. And then we, return things sometimes.
Who decides to return it?
Well, there in Chesterfield, and this is similar to a lot of places, there's a police officer whose only responsibility is to review seizures.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that person says, no, go give him his watch back or whatever it was.
Okay.
If it makes it through that level to the Commonwealth Attorney's Office, and remember, this is an important point I want to make. Commonwealth attorneys have to file a lawsuit to have something forfeited. And the lawsuit has to be filed with their name on it.
Mm-hmm.
And the name of the prosecutor handling the asset forfeiture is an assertion by that prosecutor that the seizure is well-founded in Virginia law and it comports with the facts as well. And we're not going to put our name to something if we don't believe that seizure was appropriate, and we'll tell the police department to return those
So let's
monies.
Break it down. The first issue, the first sort of call made on whether or not something that's taken should be returned is made by the police department.
Yes.
So the same department that took the stuff, then a different officer looks at it and goes, well, yeah, this is good, or no, you really need to give this one back.
Correct. It's impossible for all the folks on the streets that deal with individuals on a daily basis to have as much knowledge about these matters as, somebody specifically tasked with it and trained with it who works in that area all the time.
Sure, they don't necessarily know what the forfeiture law says and the nuances of it.
Correct.
And then the next thing that happens is the Commonwealth's attorney's office, if this stuff is taken, let's say somebody takes my $100 out of my wallet, what's the process? What kind of paper is filed, right? Tell me what happens to it. Where's it go? What happens?
Well, typically money is counted by two officers to ensure, that there's no misallocation of money by the officers on the street. It's counted, it's deposited in an asset forfeiture account that bears interest.
Mm-hmm.
Then the police department, again, the report of that seizure gets routed through that officer that's tasked with reviewing it. If he believes that the forfeiture or the seizure was appropriate, he'll give notice of it to the Commonwealth Attorney. We get a police report, paperwork.
What happens if he doesn't think it was appropriate?
He'll tell the officers, return the money, and that's that.
How's the officer return the money?
Well, the person from whom the money was taken is that's documented in the report, their address, their contact information.
You mean there's a police report filed when they take the money to begin with?
Yes.
Okay. Even though there's not necessarily any crime, sometimes there'll be a crime charge.
Most often there is a crime charge.
Uh-huh.
So there's a police report that's incident to the criminal offense, but not always. But I would say that more than 90% of the time there is a crime charge.
Okay. And then the cop gives the money back.
Yes.
Is there any record of this anywhere? Is there a way to sort of look at the You're telling me this is 10%. Is there a statistical record somewhere in the system that, for example, someone could Freedom of Information Act request that would show how many times this money is taken and then returned, or so that you could vet and make sure that the cops hadn't taken money and then just not filed any paperwork and not returned it?
I'm not aware of the internal police department's procedures, but I don't. My understanding is that there aren't strict records kept of the amounts in an aggregate sense, just kind of a case-by-case-by-case sort of a reporting.
Okay, it's time for us to take a little break. We'll be back shortly.
Straight Talk This Morning on 94.7 is supported by Impulse Gay Social Club, Charlottesville's private late-night dance club, open Fridays and Saturdays from 10 until 5.
Dreams can come true.
Impulse features DJs and live music, rag and burlesque shows, plus karaoke. You can find Impulse off Route 29 in the Old Ming Dynasty building. That's Impulse Gay Social Club. Website impulsegsc.org. That's impulse-gsc.org.
Okay, welcome back. I'm Andre Hakes, and this is Straight Talk on 94.7 WPVC. We are here today talking about civil forfeiture with John Childrey of the Chesterfield Commonwealth Attorney's Office and Rob Pogenglass of the ACLU. Rob, I saw some interesting facial expressions. Again, you know, this is radio, so y'all out there can't see them, but those facial expressions said to me, ooh, 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 I want to comment on this. I disagree. Let's hear it.
Well, at one point, John said that, you know, in the vast majority of these situations, a crime is charged. And the reality is we just don't know the answer to that. One of the recommendations that he mentioned that the Crime Commission came up with is that police ought to document when they charge a crime if they're seizing money from somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Right now in Virginia, they don't tell that to the state. They don't. The Department of Criminal Justice Services in Richmond administers the Civil Asset Forfeiture Sharing Program. And right now, law enforcement don't have to tell DCJS whether or not they charge a crime when they seize money for somebody for the purpose of doing a forfeiture.
So
we don't have
any
record.
There's not a statistic available that says, you know, in we did 100 forfeitures and, you know, charges were issued in X percent of
right.
those cases.
Right. We don't know that right now. And that's one of the recommendations that I think the administration is going to adopt, and that's a positive step.
Do we know whether or not they're taking money and not reporting it at all?
I mean, we don't know what we don't know.
Right. Okay. Well, fair enough. Is there some record, maybe a better way to formulate that question is there some record available every time a forfeiture happens so that you would be able to say, this is the number of times that, I don't mean the forfeiture is complete, I mean something is seized. Are we able to say, you know, we made, you know, 10,000 seizures or 100 seizures
So this is part of the problem. So in the first part of your question, you asked, is there a record every time a forfeiture happens?
Mm-hmm,
and then
mm-hmm.
the last part you
right,
asked, is
yeah.
there a record every time a seizure happens?
I think what I meant was seizure.
Yeah, okay. John might know the answer better than I do, but, you know, I don't know. I mean, do you trust your police department 100% to record that sort of thing?
Is there supposed to be a record made every time something is seized?
The records that and this the records that I'm aware of are when the police department notifies the Commonwealth Attorney of the seizure.
Okay.
If that notice isn't given, again, I'm not sure the internal you know requirements or the procedures for the police department to follow, or whether or not there's you know SOPs that are issued by the DCJS.
In other words, if the police officer takes my money, the next up police officer who's reviewing it decides give it back, and it never goes to a proceeding to the Commonwealth's attorney, then there's no record of it happening.
In my experience, police departments are very, very good about handling money. Now, you know, how do you deal with corrupt police officers? Are there corrupt police officers? I'm sure there are. I think the vast majority of police officers are you know hardworking public servants that take their badge seriously, and in my experience there is a paper trail of these things. The money is not seized by one officer. It's you know usually a team of either street drug folks or the vice narcotics detectives that work as a unit that are kind of tasked with looking at drug dealers and kind of work in this area. And the Commonwealth Attorney, just so your listeners know, is independent of the police department. We work with them, but we don't work for them, and they don't work for us.
Well, I mean, I understand what you're saying. What you're saying amounts to, hey, most of these people are acting in good faith. I get that, but that isn't really my question. My question is there a process by which, when something is seized, if it doesn't go to the Commonwealth Attorney, there is some record that it was seized?
I believe, again, that there would be a police report that would be made.
And that record would be in the possession of the police department that seized it?
Yes.
And so that would be not something necessarily subject to FOIA?
Well, FOIA has a number of exclusions, one of which is ongoing criminal investigations. If the investigation is no longer ongoing, I don't think that exception would apply, and I think FOIA would require a dissemination of that information. If you know about it.
So you think if a person filed a FOIA request to see about, getting a copy of the police report that shows that their money was taken, assuming there wasn't any further investigation, the cops would have to cough that up under FOIA?
Not having the FOIA statute book in front of me, but yeah, that's my understanding, yes.
Rob, what do you think? Do you think that's covered?
Well, who would be claiming the FOIA exemption but the police department that had the police report in its records?
Aren't police records not subject to FOIA anyway? I mean, records is the wrong word, but the police report itself, we have a hell of a time getting a copy of a police report out of anybody.
Well, usually police reports that folks try to get access to relate to an ongoing investigation.
Right.
Which is absolutely excluded under FOIA. Now, the agency that has that information still can give it to you under FOIA.
Sure.
They're just not required to.
Right. But what about after? Let's say I decided to FOIA the records from a case that I tried last year that's over, the appeals are done. Give me the police reports. Are they going to give it to me?
Well, you'll have to ask your police department.
the question is, does FOIA say they have to give it to me?
Unless there's an exemption that applies, the record needs to be turned over, I think, within 5 days, or some response needs to be forthcoming within 5 days.
Well, yeah, but I've gotten lots of five-day responses as they go fish. I mean, of course, sometimes I get the five-day responses on the 15th day. But all right, if you are listening and have a question for one of our folks here about civil forfeiture, the studio number is 284-9470, and we would love to hear from you. Rob, I'm gonna sort of direct this one to you. I don't know if you've heard of this particular case, but I was doing a little reading, which occasionally I do, in prep for this show, and I came across this case out of Texas that was reported on in the New Yorker. It was a guy named Ron Henderson and a lady named Jennifer Boatwright, and they filed a class action. And the story, if anybody wants to look it up, the name of the story is Taken. It ran in the New Yorker August 12, 2013 issue, and it was written by staff writer Sarah Stillman. Here's my understanding of what happens in this case. Mr. Henderson and Miss Boatwright are driving down the road. They are on the way to visit family, and they have planned to, according to them, to buy a car while they're visiting the family. They get stopped by the police for driving in the left lane for more than a half mile without passing. So this officer just sees them, pulls them over. They got two little kids in the car with them, who I think are Jennifer's kids. The cop says, "Do you have any drugs in the car?" They say no, but they admit to, or somehow there is some finding of this cash. There's a few thousand dollars, and there's a pipe. There's a glass drug pipe, kind of type pipe. And the question is, what's this? And the answer is, well, it's a gift for, my cousin Sally. I mean, I don't know. There's some innocuous answer given. These folks get arrested. They're taken to the police station. And the DA comes in to the police station. The DA comes in that night, and they're all sitting there. And the DA basically gives them options. And the options are, one, you can be charged with a felony for money laundering and child endangerment, and we can put your kids in foster care right now. We can take them. CPS can take them. Or two, you can just sign over this cash to the city, and we'll let you go. See you later. Can this happen in Virginia? Is this something that happens in Virginia? This is a Texas case, by the way.
We haven't gotten any complaints of cases like that. But, I mean, imagine being in that situation and then coming public, making your situation public. I mean, if someone had threatened you with charges like that, why would you want to go public? Why would you want to go to the press or go to the ACLU with your story if you thought that making it public could bring that power of the government back at you?
Well, I mean, the big scary thing about this case is the use of the threat of CPS. Mm-hmm. You know, we're going to take your kids if you don't give us your money. Yeah, that's what's kind of horrifying about this story. Is that a possibility in Virginia? Could that happen? Could an officer say to somebody by the side of the road, you know, you either agree to this forfeiture and, you know, go away and we don't hear from you again, or we're going to call CPS?
Well, I mean, that would be really bad acting by the prosecutor involved. And you know, earlier, before we came in here, we were talking about bad actions by prosecutors. I mean, it does happen. I think, you know, John's going to say, you know, prosecutors look at these, and if they don't want to put their names on them, they're not going to go forward. Is there a prosecutor out there who might try something like that? Yeah, and that's why, you know, at the ACLU, we believe that this system ought to be reformed, not, you know, not for the vast majority of people like John who aren't abusing the system, but for the few people that might.
What do you think about that, John? What do you think about that story? Is that possible to happen here?
In my experience, nothing like that would happen in Virginia. In fact, the Crime Commission, Rob mentioned Delegate Cole's bill that would require a criminal conviction before an asset forfeiture could go forward. Well, that bill was passed in the 2014 session. Mm-hmm. It was sent by the Finance Committee over to the Crime Commission for study. Mm-hmm. The Crime Commission has looked at it for months and months and months, and they had as a starting point the Washington Post story that was very critical of asset forfeiture in nationwide, mm-hmm. and they cited a bunch of abusive situations like the one you just recited. Well, the Crime Commission looked at the Washington Post stories, and they found that none of them that they could determine related to anything that happened in Virginia.
Right.
So they were encouraged by that, mm-hmm. and I personally got a phone call, I recall once, from a state trooper who had stopped a vehicle, and they had $20,000 in the car, and the trooper couldn't get the folks to give him a straight answer about where the money had come from. They mm-hmm. were traveling through Virginia on their way to Florida, and there was a little bit of a language barrier, and they, best he could determine, they were going to open a shop is what they said, mm-hmm. but they couldn't tell him the town, and he mm-hmm. just didn't believe any of it.
Right.
And he said, what do you want me to do?
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, state trooper, thank you for the call. What I'd like you to do is have those folks have a nice day, because there's no understanding that anything criminal is going on here.
Right.
And that's what happened. So it's not just a money grab. It's only if those, you know, predicate factors can be established are we going to participate in this.
And it is time for us to take a break. We'll be back very shortly. This week on Straight Talk, Deputy Commonwealth's Attorney for Chesterfield and erstwhile Deputy Attorney General of Virginia under the Cuccinelli administration, John Childrey, and ACLU lawyer Rob Hoganglass face off over civil forfeiture, the Cooch, and other things that make you go, hmm. Tune in Saturday at 10 for Straight Talk on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.
94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. I'd like to recognize Keller Reporting, our new sponsor for Andre Hague Show. It's a locally owned and operated leader in providing professional deposition services to lawyers throughout Virginia, and along with covering legal matters for the private sector, Kevlar Reporting provides litigation support services for the U.S. District Court, the Virginia Department of Medical Assistance Services, the SEC, the EEOC, and the Department for Deaf and Hard of Hearing. Cavalier Reporting understands deposition services must be delivered with a consistent accuracy every time. You can find them on the World Wide Web.
And you are back with Straight Talk with Andre Hakes. We have here Rob Hoganglass of the ACLU and John Childrey of the Commonwealth Attorney's Office in Chesterfield. Rob, you were just about to respond to something that John had said.
Well, he said he used the phrase money grab. He said it's not a money grab. And I want to talk about the profit incentive involved with civil asset forfeiture.
I think that's a great question. What kind of incentives are at work here?
Yeah, so John mentioned that civil asset forfeiture has a long history in Virginia, long roots.
Oh, I forgot to mention slavery in my list of things that have a long, long historical root in Virginia. Go ahead.
But I think one thing that's worth looking at that came out in the Crime Commission report, which is a terrific 117-page PowerPoint if you ever get a chance.
Is this report online somewhere where people can see it?
Online.
Where is it?
If you go to the Virginia State Crime Commission website mm-hmm. and go to reports, I think you'll find it there.
Okay.
So in the forfeiture report, they document how much money law enforcement agencies in Virginia have taken in from the Civil Asset Forfeiture Program. And if you look at 2006, it was $110,899 that the entire state of Virginia took in Civil Asset Forfeiture.
Statewide.
Money from drug-related Civil Asset Forfeitures.
And, all right.
And I'm going to come back to why I specify drug-related.
Because all right.
That's important, but I'll come back to that. Then up to this year, as of September of 2015, so far this year, we've taken in $5.6
million. Wow, that's a big jump. What was that 110 statistic what year?
$110,899 in 2006.
2006, and it's just about to become 2016. So in 10 years, I don't know what percentage that is, but wow.
We went to law school. We didn't do math.
Right, but, yeah, no,
but
I don't like math.
$5.6 million as of September. And I think in just in 2010 it was over 4 million. So in a matter of 4 years it went from $110,000 to over $4 million. And here's the reason why. Drug related civil asset forfeitures have a special exception under Virginia law that law enforcement get to keep 100% of what is forfeited.
Wait. You're saying that the police department, that the cop makes the decision, I'm gonna take this money. And then the other cop reviews it and says, yes, this is a good take. They're the people who get to keep the money?
That's right.
That's just in drug cases.
That's just in drug cases. So in 1991, we amended the...
Did that change? Was
yes.
it not like that before?
Right.
And now all of a sudden there's this huge number?
In 1991, we amended the Virginia Constitution. Before that, all civil asset forfeitures went to the Literary Fund.
Uh-huh.
In 1991, we amended the Constitution to allow that for drug-related asset forfeitures, law enforcement would keep the money.
Wow. Okay. So that long historical route didn't have the police that made the forfeiture getting to hold on to the money.
That's right.
And then when that incentive changed, the amount of money seized went through the roof.
Well, I guess there's about a 15-year period where it didn't. And then all of a sudden, the recession hits. 2007, 2008,
right.
And suddenly police departments are strapped for cash.
Right.
And now they've figured out civil asset forfeiture, great way to make some cash.
I'm going to stop there just for a second to, again, give that number, 284-9470, if you have a question for one of these fine gentlemen regarding civil asset forfeiture. Do you know what percentage of civil asset forfeitures are from drug cases as opposed to other kinds of cases?
Yeah, so the Crime Commission looked at that, too. Of course, non-drug-related asset forfeitures go directly to the Literary Fund, which is mm-hmm. not accessible by law enforcement agencies directly. And that totaled about $150,000 in fiscal year 14.
Okay. So
we're taking in $5.6 million, probably, well, certainly more than that in 2015 from drug-related forfeitures. And for all the other crimes that you can do a forfeiture for, we've taken in about $150,000. So that tells you a little bit about how well the profit incentive matters.
That's a pretty big increase. John, you want to address that?
I've got a kind of a hypothetical that I'd like to give, and Rob's exactly right about the facts and figures that he just cited. The ACLU and other folks and Delegate Cole, want to require the criminal conviction before a civil asset forfeiture can go forward, and the ACLU has been concerned about incentives to seize property, mm-hmm. and if the police department gets to keep the property, mm-hmm. there's going to be more incentive, and maybe there's an incentive to seize things that aren't appropriately seized.
Or maybe there's an incentive to seek a conviction that might not really be a very good conviction to seek, even.
Well, if you require a criminal conviction mm-hmm. before you can go forward with an asset forfeiture, wouldn't it create in a prosecutor an incentive to go forward just to make sure they can achieve that?
It might create that incentive. It might create an incentive for a police officer to shade his testimony a little more heavily than he might, but it creates a jury check on that issue. That's what it does for us.
Well, Andre, let me ask you, can you have a contingency fee arrangement in a criminal defense representation?
No, not in Virginia.
So you can't say $1,000 on your DUI charge, but if the charge goes away, then I get 10?
No.
Okay, why then should prosecutors, right, have a contingency fee associated with getting a criminal conviction? I think it's a little dangerous and potentially unethical for a prosecutor to be thinking about anything other than what's an appropriate...
Don't you think they're already thinking of it? I mean, these police departments, I know you're saying they don't supervise the Commonwealth and the Commonwealth doesn't supervise them, but they have a pretty cozy relationship in most jurisdictions.
They do.
So don't you think that already is there?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So I'm not sure this changes it a whole lot.
Well, let me just give you another example. Say a street-level dealer says he can give us information about this huge network of drug dealers that is pushing heroin that is causing people to have overdoses and die.
Okay.
And you're going to use information from the street-level dealer, and say you've seized $500 that he says, yeah, that's drug money. That's the only job I have is walking these streets and selling this poison. So he's going to give information. Say his information is fantastic. And the prosecutor believes, in his discretion, that he has, quote, worked off the charges.
Right.
Meaning he has given information that's led to 5 arrests, 3 search warrants, seizure of tens of thousands of dollars. We're not going to prosecute him
for that. He snitched. We're not going to put him in jail. I get it.
The only thing you want the prosecutor to be thinking of when he makes that decision is the appropriate disposition of that criminal charge. You don't want anything to enter his decision-making process related to
you
whatever.
You don't want him to be thinking, I'm not going to get the $500 out of his pocket?
Correct.
Okay, I understand what you're saying, but these incentives don't really seem to address the issue that Rob has brought up, which is that the police departments are keeping the money. What about addressing that incentive? Is there any legislation under consideration to roll that back, to change that rule back to what it was before? And why should the PD get this money?
Well, the theory is, and that's a great question, the theory is that you take the proceeds of criminal enterprises, criminal behavior, and you give those resources to the police departments that investigate that behavior to let them better able to investigate future behavior. That's the model. And I think it's worked very well for Virginia.
Well, I think it's resulted in lots of citizens losing millions of dollars. I'm not sure it's worked real well. I mean, I'm sure it's worked real well for the police departments.
Well, these are funds that have been generated illegally. These are funds that have been proven to be illegally generated by
the SF-4 process. Nobody fought it. I mean, here's something that happens in my practice, right? I do criminal defense. And somebody may come and they might want to hire me. I don't do that many drug cases, but I do one once in a while. Somebody wants to hire me for a drug charge. And I say, okay, well, that'll be, you know, this is a big felony charge. It's going to be $10,000, $20,000, $30,000. It is what it is. They all call their aunt and their mama and their uncle and their grandpa, and they put together some money and they hire me, and I'm going to defend this criminal charge. Let's say we're going to have a jury trial, right? And then they say, oh, by the way, I got this forfeiture proceeding. Well, I'm not going to do 2 court hearings now for that amount of money. I'm going to say, well, you know, I really don't do civil. Or I'm going to say, okay, I'll do that, but it's going to be X thousands of dollars more. And that person might not have that money. Or worse yet, what if it's somebody who doesn't have that kind of money to hire me to begin with? They're just somebody who gets a public defender. Does a public defender go into court and fight the forfeiture? No, they don't, because it's civil. So don't a lot of those people lose their money in those forfeitures simply because they don't have the money to hire an attorney?
Well, the process is that the criminal case and the civil case are absolutely separate.
Exactly, which is why
statute.
I'm not doing it.
And there is also a provision that the civil case can be stayed while the criminal case is pending. And I think that's very important as well, because there are tools in civil cases that are just not applicable to the criminal case.
Like, discovery?
Discovery. We can ask folks, request for production of documents. Give me your last 5 years of tax returns. Show me where you've generated this, you know, income that led to this $20,000.
Sure. Or give me, as defense counsel, copies of the police reports.
Correct.
Or the video of the interrogation of my client
Set out every fact that we are basing our... Correct.
Do they?
Yes. It's common practice for the asset forfeiture to be stayed while the criminal case is pending.
In my experience, I have seen that. I have seen those forfeiture cases get stayed. But I don't know if that's required, is it,
well,
Rob?
Here's what Delegate Cole's bill would require. His bill would literally require the stay of the forfeiture proceedings until the criminal case is over.
Okay.
So the very thing that John is arguing for is what Delegate Cole's bill would do.
It would say you can seize this money, you can hold on to it, but you have to wait until we see if the person's convicted or not to take it and go buy yourself whatever you're buying yourself. What do you think about that?
Well, here's some other problems with the requirement that there's a criminal conviction.
Mm-hmm.
Say that the person who's charged with a crime makes bail,
mm-hmm.
and they flee.
Okay.
There's not going to be a criminal conviction.
Okay.
Until they bring them back.
They can be tried in their absence, can't they? If they're charged,
it's almost
served.
Never done. Usually it's put into what's called a fugitive file, and they're never convicted.
Right.
Suppose the person dies.
Okay.
There's never going to be a criminal conviction.
Okay.
Suppose we don't know where or who is responsible for the crime.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a case where there was about $14,000, if memory serves, found in a hotel room
mm-hmm.
from which drugs had been distributed.
Mm-hmm.
When the search warrant was executed, the room was empty. There was
mm-hmm.
nobody to charge. But there was $14,000 left in the room.
Yeah, but that's abandoned property.
Some of which included police buy money that we had sent in with an informant to buy these drugs.
Sure.
So we knew that the money was drug money. We just couldn't charge anybody. There's never going to be a criminal conviction in that case, but the money was forfeited. We filed a lawsuit against money found in a Tigger doll.
Well, what happens if you found money? I love the Tigger doll reference, by the way. Bouncy, fun.
Yeah.
What if you found money like that in a hotel room and you didn't file a forfeiture proceeding? What happens to it? I mean, it's abandoned property, isn't it? Doesn't it escheat to the state in any way?
It very well might. I don't know.
Just the cops don't necessarily get it.
I think that's right. And just to be clear, the money that is seized in drug cases, 10% goes to DCJS if the forfeiture goes through. The remaining 90% is split between the prosecutor's office and the police department.
You are listening to 94.7 WPVC, the Progressive Voice of Charlottesville. This is Straight Talk, and we are talking about civil asset forfeitures. The number, if you want to call in, is 284-9470, and we are just about to go to a break.
Straight Talk This Morning on 94.7 is supported by Impulse Gay Social Club, Charlottesville's private late-night dance club, open Fridays and Saturdays from 10 until 5.
Dreams can come.
Impulse features DJs and live music, drag and burlesque shows, plus karaoke. You can find Impulse off Route 29 in the Old Ming Dynasty building. That's Impulse Gay Social Club. Website impulsegsc.org. That's impulse-gsc.org.
So, gentlemen, here's a question that has come in over Facebook. The question is, can a Commonwealth's attorney ethically include in a plea agreement? So we're talking about a criminal charge where somebody is charged and they're working out a plea deal. Can the Commonwealth attorney put in that plea agreement that they are going to forfeit whatever the amount of the property is? Is that ethical for the attorney to do?
I'm aware of no ethical prohibition against that practice. I believe the best practice is to keep those matters strictly separate, if possible, to be handled by different Commonwealth attorneys, even within the same office. I'm very, very uncomfortable negotiating a money in the same transaction as I'm negotiating what should happen in a criminal case.
Huh. I have seen it. I mean, I have seen it before. I am not aware of any rule of professional ethics that prevents it. But I think it's actually fairly common practice for that to happen. And when you're looking at somebody who's trying to plead out a crime and you say, you know, give me your money or I'm going to put you in jail longer, most people will give you their money. What do you want to say, Rob?
I agree. I think it's terrible practice and should be avoided at all costs. You know, this is just another argument for Delegate Cole's bill. Keep the civil proceeding till the end of the criminal case, let the criminal case finish, and then deal with the forfeiture.
I still don't understand why it's a good idea for this money to go to the police department instead of the literary fund. It seems like it should go to some kind of education, which also has a salutary effect on crime rates. Either one of you have a comment on that?
I will just tell you my experience that the elected Commonwealth attorney in Chesterfield is a man named Billy Davenport. He's been the Commonwealth attorney since 1988. And in the 5 years that I was handling asset forfeitures in Chesterfield, I don't believe I had one conversation about the amount of monies coming in or asset forfeiture cases at all with Mr. Davenport. So I just don't know that, my experience, that there's a problem with it. And I will tell you this, the money cannot go to things that are already budgeted.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be used for training. It has to be used for equipment. So it's not paying salaries of people.
Well, let's talk about equipment for a second. I mean, I've noticed there's been a trend over time toward the sort of militarization of police, civil police, because what's happening is you'll have military equipment that comes back, and that military equipment is outdated or what have you, and they don't want to just destroy it, so they give it to a local law enforcement agency to use, right? Oh, here, that's how we end up with these like troop carriers in Ferguson and, you know, weird kind of paramilitary looking civilian police force video. My thinking on that is sometimes if you give somebody a new toy, they feel the need to use that new toy. And so you end up in situations where police are acting in a more militant way because they have that gear than they might otherwise be acting. And currently, it seems like we have a movement afoot to sort of cut down on police brutality and violence by police shootings. It's a big controversy. I wonder if giving this money to these departments and then letting them buy equipment like that with it contributes to the kind of violence that we're seeing. What do you guys think about that?
That's a great question. I mean, that is there's been a lot of comment currently about the equipment used by police and just the appearance of police officers. But, you know, and that being said, that they have a very real, you know, risk that they're responding to a lot, and they just want to make sure that they have the equipment to deal with whatever situation might arise. So it's kind of a policy question, I guess.
I don't know. Rob, any thoughts? No, anybody buy any margarita machines with it? I saw the comedy sketch on it.
We use the money to buy computers, copiers, paper, things like that.
No margarita machines in Virginia?
I haven't seen one.
No. Oh man. Well, you were involved, John, in a huge federal forfeiture actually during the Cuccinelli administration. There was a big money forfeiture. How much was that federal forfeiture total?
The total amount that was forfeited, and this was in a plea agreement, was in a Medicaid fraud case investigated by the AG's office. It was $198.5 million.
Wait, this was in a plea agreement?
The Abbott Labs company, the case involved their use or misbranding of the drug Depakote. And they agreed to this resolution that was achieved in the Western District of Virginia, which Charlottesville is a part of. And Timothy Hafey's office was involved.
But I know Tim.
The Ken Cuccinelli's Medicaid fraud unit investigated, spent 38,500 man hours investigating this case, traveled to 26 states, and ultimately $115 million of that $198.5 million was awarded to the AG's office,
mm-hmm.
which had a budget at that time of about $40 million. So it was worth more than the entire budget of the office, several fold. So this happened in 2013. So we almost immediately figured out that we couldn't use all this money. So we started pushing it out to law enforcement agencies in a program that I was involved with. And a lot of the money went to sheriffs, police departments, some for Commonwealth attorneys. Some money went to retirement funds, the Virginia retirement system.
So most of the players who benefited from this money were people on the prosecution side of the criminal justice system.
I would say yes.
Any of it go to the public defenders?
I don't believe any went to public defenders.
No?
No.
No. God, that's funny. I understand there was a new indoor firing range for the Albemarle County Police that was paid for out of some of those funds.
Correct. We sent out a request for recommendations. Police departments just poured in the requests. And what the folks around here wanted, Albemarle, Charlottesville, and City and UVA police departments,
uh-huh.
they kind of pooled their request, and they wanted an indoor firing range, I guess, so people didn't have to hear the shots. And I understand that
it hasn't worked. I live out Fifth Street, so
I really don't know if that's online yet.
It was nice of them to think of me, though.
But a lot of folks, like you just mentioned, they wanted an armored vehicle,
mm-hmm.
and we turned almost all those requests down. just for whatever reason. We ultimately...
You didn't think the traffic detail needed an armored vehicle to write speeding tickets?
There are armored vehicles available for regional use in Virginia, and I think we bought two armored vehicles to complete that picture of regional use availability.
But, well, so you did buy armored vehicles with the money?
Yes.
Are we talking about tanks? What are we talking about?
No, just armored personnel carriers.
Okay, sort of like what we saw in the Ferguson videos.
I've never seen one in use in Virginia, but I understand one's available for the big race in Martinsville, just kind of on call. You know, I'm not sure. But it was a neat program. We were able to fund ultimately about $40 million or so worth of police department requests out of over 80 million requests that were made. So we turned down about half the money requests.
Well, so we just have a few minutes left here. And I am unabashedly a big yellow dog Democrat, screaming liberal. But there is occasionally I find a point on which I agree with my conservative friends. And one of those points, I know it's shocking, but one of them is that the government's getting a little grabby, right? The government's gotten a little grabby with civil forfeiture lately. We've gone to $5 million in civil forfeiture. Another place I've seen this is with eminent domain. We've seen more and more eminent domain proceedings. And I'm wondering if... what do you think about that? If you think that that's sort of a general trend in society and maybe something we should be looking at. Seems like maybe one of the only bipartisan points I could raise.
Yeah. You know, I'll tell you, I never thought I would have friends in the Tea Party, but last session I discovered them. They provided the grassroots support that helped get this bill through the House, 92-6. Senator Normant killed it in the Senate. He aims to do that again. He's a big friend of law enforcement, big friend of Commonwealth Attorneys Association. He's a defense attorney. It's odd to me, but he's looking out for him. And, you know, I just encourage people to get in touch. Go to our website, acluva.org, and read more about civil asset forfeiture and get in touch with their senator and delegate. Let them know that this is important to them.
Well, at some point I'm gonna have to go tour the new firing range and see if there's any margarita machines in there. But gentlemen, thank you so much for coming today. It's been a great conversation. I really appreciate it. And that's pretty much all we've got time for today. Thanks for being here. This is 94.7 WPVC-FM, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, and you have been listening to Straight Talk. Next Saturday will be December 26th. That's the day after Christmas, in case you weren't paying attention to your Advent calendar. I hope to be sleeping off a whole lot of Christmas dinner that day, so we'll probably replay a show from the vast history of this program. What is this, number 7 or 8, maybe? So here's my thought for you guys. Send us a Facebook message if you want to weigh in on which show you'd like to hear that day. The following Saturday, January 2, we will have the oh-so-recently elected clerk of the Albemarle County Circuit Court, John Zug, who has been a prosecutor in Albemarle and Charlottesville pretty much as long as I've been practicing law here, on the show, and he's going to be talking about specific issues in the prosecution of domestic violence cases. Tune in as John and I disagree about nearly everything under the sun, yet still manage to be polite with each other. I'm Andre Hakes, signing off for Straight Talk. Have a great weekend.
This has been Straight Talk with your host, Andre Hakes, brought to you by Tucker Griffin Barnes. Production is from Olivia August, engineering Mike Friend. Be sure and listen again next Saturday morning at 10 o'clock for Straight Talk on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.